intentions were always what? We're always, it's all about amplifying that, right? It's all about learning more, processing more, doing more, right? Without end.
Right.
So the message of Dharma is a very different message, right? And it's a capacity because in the world it's a capacity that is for most of us never mentioned or rarely mentioned, right? In our growing up and in our personal, professional work development. The accent is always on doing, achieving, getting, and, worrying, ruminating, remembering, let's talk about the old times, right? People get together and just talk about the old times. Right? Or let's talk about, what we're doing, what we're looking forward to. So it's just very common for in our social involvements, we just endlessly go over past and future. Now again, we're not hermits. We don't live in monasteries. We're engaged in the world. So the object here is not to reject all that. The object is simply to understand that endlessly involved in that kind of activity keeps us involved in that type of activity. And there's nobody saying to us, stop. Right? Just stop. Right? Where are you right now? Where's your body? Now, where's your breath right now? What do you see right now? What do you hear right now? What do you smell, taste, touch right now? What are you feeling right now? And just, that's enough to be present to that. In Buddhist meditation tradition, it's saying, the untrained mind is always outflowing. It's always going out, right? And all the objects that appear to it, whether they be things we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or thoughts that appear, all the things that are appearing, we're going out to, right? And we're grabbing onto. And grabbing on means we're making a story about it. You know, the story could be, I like that, or I don't like that. Story could be, I want that, I don't want that. I mean, there's very simple stories and there's very elaborate. You know, he did this and then she did that and then this one happened and that happened and I feel this and you feel that and you know what I mean? And you're a this and I'm a that and, right? There's all that, so the stories can be more elaborated. Right? And individuals carry stories, families carry stories, nations carry stories. And so people live in the stories, right? We've gotten so far away from reality that all the stories that we create, either individually or socially or whatever, we believe are true. Right? And we don't have a capacity to stop and come back and let go and relax and just ask ourselves, where am I right now? What's my reality right now? Because the whole time all this mental confabulation is going on, right? There is another whole life that's being lived. The life of the senses, the life of the body, sensations, the emotions that arise from all that, that's life too. And we could say that is perhaps a greater part of our life and a more fulfilling part of our life than the mental activity. Now, again, mental activity certainly has its, for many people, mental activity is part of their professions, part of their careers. It's good to be able to discriminate, traffic signs and things like that. But it's not necessarily a means for happiness and joy and equanimity. That's the problem. And so that is why, we live in a world today where, intellectual, conceptual, technological, which are just, manifestations of a very active, inventive, imaginative mind, right, is just, unstoppable. Advances, so-called. And yet at the same time, the quotient of human happiness, well-being, it's hard to say if it's in decline, because there's not a very accurate baseline, but certainly great troubles in our world, great troubles in our individuals emotionally, families, society. So, again, it's not as if we turn our back on civilization. We don't turn our back on technology and advances in the various fields, medicine. But we have to understand that in terms of individual and social happiness and well-being, there's something totally different that's involved in achieving that. And the wonderful thing, because in terms of technological advances, you're always kind of moving, new frontiers. Well, the truth is, in terms of this capacity to be happy, to be loving, to be wise, to be a good human being, this kind of wisdom of how to go about that is ancient. It's kind of interesting. Right? It's we don't have to invent anything. It's all was established centuries, thousands of years ago. Why? Because the wise men of ancient times simply studied human beings. And human experience and the human mind. And so therefore, their truths are timeless because we are still human beings and we are still the same. And we still have bodies and hearts and minds and they more or less still function the same way. So we are very lucky that while the technology for human progress is something that is unfolding, the technology for healing and transformation of individual human beings, and which means society, is readily available to us. And it is not only readily available to us as a philosophy or as a written textual teaching, but it's living. It has been replicated generation after generation after generation. It is tested. It has been experimented with in the best sense. It is these teachings and practices have been experimented with by millions and millions of human beings of all types, shapes, and sizes, and generations, and eras, and have proved to be always effective. So I think that's very scientifically sound, and something therefore that we can, once we've investigated these teachings and practices, we can feel good confidence in. They've been around for hundreds of years, thousands of years, and they've been of constant benefit. We know that many of the products, like Toyotas or whatever, we know that we all these things that we rely on, we find often they have problems they're not as reliable as they think, and then also they break down over time. But if you invest your energy and your interest in these profound teachings and practices that are fairly simple and understandable, I think you'll find that over time they don't wear out, they don't break down, they don't have to be replaced. They just work better and better for you. Any questions tonight before we get into Han Shan, great Chinese Chan master? Yes. Yeah, I think it's, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so in a very personal way, right, we can say as a process, meditation is developing this capacity to know the mind, to know the doer, right, to know, you know, to know the thinker of the thoughts, we could say. So it's a very profound experience. And then, of course, there is life. And as you say, the unfolding of life is, it can take many twists and turns. And for many people, it at some point in life, it turns toward pain, suffering. You know, most of us in our ordinary lives experience it. And we know some people experience it to extraordinary experiences, both individually or like in Haiti or other places, or Congo, you know, places collectively, there is incredible suffering. There are truths that one learns from deep meditation. And again, I would say people like the Buddha and Christ and the Masters, again, you've heard me say before, they did not, you know, the Buddha did not study Buddhism. He didn't read any books about Buddhism. We don't know if he read anything. So where did his great wisdom and understanding come from? He just studied his own mind. And he looked deeply at life around him. So if one takes this more expansive, right, in terms of Buddhist meditation, it's a real stopping and a real looking deeply. It also reveals certain truths, one of the truths that it unfolds to us is that there is suffering. You know, the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering. But that there's a cause of suffering. And that there is a way to remediate a lot of the causes of suffering to create happiness, or ultimately nirvana, the cessation of suffering, nirodha. For example, one can go through a very painful, traumatic experience, physical, let's say physical experience, or one of great loss, right? Somebody you love and is close to, a family member, a child, you know, dies in an auto accident. You know, they leave your house, they're going to school or something, and you know, some terrible thing happens. I mean, I'm just, right? And of course, there's a sadness in that, isn't there? But we know for many people, it doesn't just stay at that level. It becomes much more painful than that. Because one can create wider and wider and more vaster and vaster stories about what happened and how it shouldn't have happened, how it's unfair how it happened, right? I think one of the gifts that looking deeply at situations gives us is an understanding, and again, this is one of the basic truths of Buddhism, is a cause and effect, that everything that happens, happens for a cause. Now, we may not like that cause, right? And we may not like the effect, but that's our own judgment, subjective judgment and evaluation of that unfolding. That if we look deeply, we will see, why did this happen? This happened because of that. And that will produce this. You know, I think, you know, we're doing the teachings of Han Shan, and I don't know if we've done it here, but I've been teaching them in different places. But there's a place where it says, you know, from the point of view of human beings, you know, a hurricane is a disaster, right? Because it can create such devastation, right? A hurricane. But from the point of view of nature, a hurricane and a gentle sea breeze are the same, right? They're just different faces, different aspects of nature. I think, in terms of your question, it is that capacity of having that deeper understanding of how reality operates allows one to deal with the ups and downs, the successes and failures, the gains and the losses, the birth and the death, that we all, in our more rational moments, would say, yeah, this is life. This stuff happens. We may not like it that it happens. We may not want it to be happen, right? But if we take an unvarnished objective view at human life and human history and what it means and what's happened, we cannot help but say, this is normal, right? Death is normal. Sickness is normal. Gain and loss are normal. Up and down is normal. Nice weather and terrible weather is normal. Right? Good times and bad times is normal. Right? And so it is our ignorance. In Buddhism, we have these words, ignorance. It doesn't mean like we're stupid. It sort of means like we're stupid. But it doesn't mean like we're stupid in an intellectual way. Ignorance really means we're ignorant of the way things really are. So in traditional spirituality, like Buddhism, wisdom means is the wisdom of knowing things as they are. And a lot of us, we don't like that. That feels like a surrender, right? You know, because we want things to be a certain way. It was funny. I was in Naples on Sunday with a woman who asked me a question, and I forget what we were talking about, but she said, she brought up a specific issue. I'm just guessing it was her husband, but I don't know. She was saying, well, what do you do with somebody, you know, if you just like them to be a little more sensitive? You know, and you've talked to them about it, and they just, you know, won't be more sensitive. And this was obviously causing her suffering. To be in a relationship with a man or husband who was not as sensitive as she would like him to be. But my response to her was, so it sounds as if he's, according to your criteria, not very sensitive, is he? But he is who he is, isn't he? And if you look deeply into the cause and conditions that have created him, right, you wouldn't help but understanding why he is the way he is. And he might be quite happy the way he is. Right? It sounds like you're suffering because you don't want him to be the way he is. You want him to be the way you want him to be. And I would imagine this is causing you suffering, and if you're very overt in this, it is probably causing him suffering. Right? And it's causing suffering to your relationship. And it's like she got it. She went, oh. Yeah, he's just who he is. I'm the one who's imposing my, I'm trying to control him to make him into how I want him to be. And you know, if he's doing the same thing with her, which he might, because he's probably, if he was there, he'd probably say what? Well, I got a problem with somebody who's just too sensitive. Right? I mean, you know, everything is sensitive. You know what I mean? Right? And we laugh, right? But this is common, and we don't realize. Again, it doesn't mean in relationships we can't communicate and dialogue, and it can't be, you know, I'm not, but I'm talking about that that incapacity. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh always says, love is understanding. When I first heard that years ago, I went, what? You know, I thought love was what? You really love somebody and like them and want to be with them and we're always happy. You know what I mean? When they're with, it's like a feeling kind of state, right? That's love. And he said, no, love is when you understand somebody, that's love. You know, no Valentine's Day, no hearts and flowers. It was interesting, right? To love, when you understand somebody, that means you love them. When he said understanding, he means you are willing to let go of yourself, right? And totally enter into somebody else, right? To enter into them, to understand their past, to understand all the causes and conditions and create them, right? And when you do that, you then can't help but go what? Oh, I understand perfectly why they are the way they are and why they can't be anything other than who they are. Right? We know, I mean, you know, when you reverse it, how do we know that somebody loves us? We know that one of the great things about feeling loved is what? They accept us for who we are. So when it's coming our way, we get it. Right? That's what we want. We want to be with somebody, when they look at us, they just total acceptance. We say what? We all want what? Unconditional love, don't we? I mean, but it's kind of a one-way street. It's like, that's what we want from the other. But when it comes to how what we want to give, you know, but we want them to be a certain way, don't we? So, I mean, that's, we do that with the world. Right? It's the same thing. Now, coming back to meditation, what is, well, when you watch your mind, one of the interesting things that happens is what? You realize your mind has a life of its own, doesn't it? Thoughts come and go. Feelings come and go. the most bizarre things show up in the mind, don't they? Right? High-minded thoughts, low-minded thoughts, right? Thoughts you're proud of, thoughts you don't want anybody to know about, that they arise in your mind, right? I mean, but if you're practicing honestly, you develop the capacity to say, it is what it is. Right? It is, my mind is what it is. And I can accept it. And I can learn to work with it just as it is. A lot of people, a lot of people I think have trouble with meditation, mindfulness, is because they don't enjoy the experience of having to be with themselves. You know? It can be kind of a painful experience. And it also can be a very kind of embarrassing or humiliating experience when you really begin to pay attention to what's going on in there. Right? I mean, it's a mess, it's a zoo, and it's often worse than that. Right? And so a lot of people, a lot of people try meditation and they, especially this kind of meditation. You know, there are a lot of meditations where there's more visualization or mantra things which really can kind of give you something to get out. You know, you really don't have to be present to yourself. You can really just get into something. But in this path of Zen, in which we are developing the capacity to look directly at the mind as it is, there has to be a capacity to be present to ourselves as we are and to come into a place of deep acceptance. Not a struggle, not ashamed, not embarrassed, not humiliated, or not upset. You know, we want a different mind, don't we? Right? We start our meditation, we get a good look at what's going on in there, many of us go, that's not the mind that I want. I'd like to have the Buddha's mind or something like that. Thich Nhat Hanh's mind. But again, that's just more of our unwillingness to just see clearly what is right here. So Hanshan. He says, our mind and body are by nature pure, but we sully them with unskillful thoughts and deeds. In order to restore ourselves, and again, this is several months now that I've been reading from the maxims of Master Hanshan, who was a Chinese Chan or Zen master in the years 1546 to 1623, great Zen master. He said, our mind and body are by nature pure, but we sully them with unskillful thoughts and deeds. In order to restore ourselves to the original purity, we need only to clean away the accumulated dirt. But how do we proceed with the cleansing process? Do we put a barrier between us and the occasions of our bad habits? Do we remove ourselves from the places of temptation? No. We cannot claim victory by avoiding the battle. The enemy is not our surround. I didn't do this one here last time, did I? No. So again, this is classic Buddhism. Our minds are by nature pure. Right? Our minds are not dirty. Our minds are not sinful. Our minds are not fallen. Our minds are not, our mind nature is pure. Right now, each of you are listening to me with your awareness, right? Right in this moment, you hear me and you listen. And in this awareness, it is uncontaminated. There may be people here who are rich. There may be people who are poor. There may be people who've had a great life. There may be people who have had a terrible life. There may be people who had a good day. There may be people who had a bad day today. But in this moment, when you listen in this moment of awareness, right? None of that matters. This moment of awareness is fresh, uncreated. You don't have to bring all that in, do you? You can just listen. You hear the sound, right? We just hear it. We all hear it together. We don't have to judge. We don't have to say, see, some of us might go, hey, hey, shut up out there. We're meditating. And you're disturbing my meditation, right? Right? We might think like that, right? And say, hey, Mel, do we go out there and shut those people up and tell them we're meditating? But the disturbance is not out there, is it? They're not disturbing my mind. I'm disturbing my mind by getting all bent out of shape because of those sounds, right? So the mind is pure. The mind is unsullied. We sully them with all that stuff, all those projections, all those constrictions. The sound's gone now, right? I mean, What an idiot I was for getting so upset 5 minutes ago. You know? Trying to meditate. People are so selfish. Right? And so inconsiderate. Right? You know, right? And we could go off on that one. And we can think about all the inconsiderate people there are in the world, or all the people in our life, and all the people who've disturbed us over the years, right? Never, ever attending to, you know, the times when we've walked by and maybe just, you know, talked to people meditating. That doesn't concern us. Right? So we could grab onto that passing sound, make a story, allow it to disturb us, get an emotional reaction, do the whole thing, right? Or we could what? Just let it be. Do people have a right to walk by? Of course. Do they have a right to talk? Of course. Our meditation has to be deeper than pure reactivity. Again, we're cultivating what? Equilibrium. Things are quiet when we meditate, good. Things are noisy when we meditate, good. The problem is not out there. The problem is in here. So that's why Master Han Shan, you know, we're talking 1600, so we're like, you know, over 400 years ago. He's advising us, don't put a barrier between us and the occasions of our bad habits. Do not remove yourselves from the places of temptation. We cannot claim victory by avoiding the battle. The enemy is not our surroundings, it is ourselves. How wonderful. And again, this is very much the Zen tradition, and this is very much the lay tradition in Buddhism. You know, we do not have to cut ourselves off from the world. We do not have to cut ourselves off from the senses and sensual experiences. We don't have to cut ourselves off from the world of desire. That is not the problem. The problem is how we attach, constrict, hold on to these experiences. He says, you know, if we purify the mind by avoiding situations that disturb us, then how are we transforming anything? We have our peace of mind only because we avoid situations that disturb it. Which means as soon as I enter into those situations, my mind will get disturbed again. So my peace of mind is conditioned on externals, right? So we want to be able to take our practice everywhere. And if we're in a difficult situation, that's good. Because it means what? Why is it difficult for us? Because we are holding on to something, aren't we? There's something we don't want to let go of. It's not easy to acknowledge that we ourselves are the source of our suffering. And that there is something that we don't want to let go of. There's something we want to hold on to here. But coming back to that earlier question, you know, the meditation lets us see. Those people walking by were not disturbing my mind. Right? The hurricane does not disturb nature. The hurricane is nature, isn't it? Ears hear sounds, don't they? Eyes see things, don't they? And they just come and go. They just come and go. We don't have to grab onto everything and make a judgment about everything. We don't have to cling to everything. Like we said earlier, there is a difficulty in this life. There is a trauma. There is pain. Some of it that's caused by physical things, hurricanes, earthquakes. Wars, psychological things, losses, relationships. When we go through these experiences, they are painful, aren't they? So why do we continually ruminate about them? For what purpose? It was always amazing to me in my years as a psychotherapist how people would describe terrible things that happened to them in their life. Right? And yet would constantly want to revisit it. Wasn't it painful enough the first time? You know, why do we always keep revisiting these things from the past? Why do we always continue to worry about things in the future? It is that very process itself which destroys our well-being, destroys our happiness, destroys our capacity to love and be present. I mean, this is life, right? And somebody once said, nobody gets through life unscathed, does it? Right? We all get beaten up, right, to one degree or another, right? Some of us, life just beats us up. And some of us, we realize we just beat ourselves up. And a lot of us, you know, do a combination of that. But that's just life, isn't it? And what Dharma... What a Dharma is about is it helps us in the midst of all that to understand clearly what is going on and gives us the capacity to understand and gives us the capacity to heal and transform. So even in this difficult life, we can be happy. We can be loving human beings. And we have the capacity of helping others, right? I mean, that really is the best thing we can do with our time, right? Once we have liberated ourselves from our own ignorance and our own suffering, then to be of help to others. So that twofold that twofold practice in Buddhism, it's called the Bodhisattva way, by the way, is a way in which personal liberation and social liberation are intimately tied. Right? We know that most of the great teachers didn't come to their great understandings and then retire to Florida to play golf. Luckily, most of the great teachers, after they came to their realizations, after they did their own hard work to transform themselves, most of them devoted most of their lives afterwards to sharing the fruits with others. Because I think when you've gone through your own process of transformation and healing, and you see that it is possible, and you understand that if it's possible for you, it's possible for everyone, then you can't help, as the Buddha did, to look around and see so much suffering in the world and see, you know, these people need some help. These people need some help, right? They have the capacity for joy. They have the capacity for loving relationships. They have the capacity for peace in their hearts and minds, and yet they don't know how to do it. So it is for this reason that I think teachers stay in the world. Because they understand that they are no different than everybody else, and that if they can do it, everyone can do it. Any questions about all this? So is everybody going to sign on? It's a personal signing on. Interesting enough, you sign on within yourself. Yes, do you have a question?
I was just saying that it seems like you answered a lot of the questions that we might have at the time. Like, I have a few questions beforehand, and then you go ahead and answer it. And I go to the John Mogyo Meditation Society, and I noticed that when I have any questions, they always seem to get answered at the time. I'm not really sure what that is.
Any other questions or comments before we end for tonight? So I realize I'm scheduled to be here in 2 weeks, but in 2 weeks there's an interesting Dharma teacher from Canada who's going to be in Florida. I know him. His name is Ian Prattis. He's a very interesting guy. He's very much a social activist, very much somebody who's he's written books. He's very involved in his community in Ottawa. He's very strong, engaged Buddhist. So he'll be in Florida. Invited him to come and share his Dharma with us. It's always good to hear different teachers present their Dharma in different ways. So he'll be here in 2 weeks. And next week?
Coming events. I was going to open up a discussion on change and permanence and practice. And Ian and Alex on the February 25th and on the 27th is a day of mindfulness in Naples.
So there will be a discussion on impermanence and practice, change and practice after meditation next week. Also, there we will be having a 4-day meditation retreat at the end of March here at the Franciscan Center in Tampa. I believe registration is now open online. If you go to our new website, you can see it there, and you can register there. I think you could even pay there, right? PayPal and all these. So for those of you who are interested in experiencing a practice at a deeper level, having more time to really put everything down and spend 4 days cultivating mindfulness and awareness. The teachings will be based on the Anapanasati Sutra, a sutra full awareness of the breath. in which the Buddha delineated 16 meditations as kind of the basis of the meditative path. And so the teachings and the practices during the retreat will be based on that sutra. Anything else? Any other?
Generosity is always a nice thing, and we all have an opportunity, you know, we've got these wonderful teachings, there's an opportunity to show gratitude and generosity to help enhance the group and the teachings and to make a donation to the Lotus Room. And I think there's tea in the back and an opportunity to you know, visit one another, and there's a series of, you know, it's an opportunity if you have questions for people. There's a series of folks who've been practicing here for quite some time who are involved in something called Sangha Care, or just anybody at random, you can have an opportunity to visit with people about your practice and about this opportunity.
There are some people from the Sangha Care group, such as Nancy. And Susan, and Alex, and there's Doug. So if you have a question about the Florida Community Mindfulness or the Sangha here, the community here in Tampa, or any questions about what you've heard tonight, please feel free to pester them with questions. So thank you all for coming again. Please understand that I'm doing my best not to give a sermon in that traditional religious sense, but trying to give you things to kind of plant some seeds or stir up some stuff inside you. So I say that in the sense of, you know, don't... take it with you. That's what I'm trying to say. Take it with you. Hopefully, if anything that was said tonight you found meaningful in any way, or challenging in any way, or upsetting in any way, or confusing in any way, good. Good. Please take it with you and put it into practice in your life. So thank you for coming.